and as an independent journalist. We'll also hear some book talk that we had this week with Chelsea Perkins, Heidi Holton, and Kari Hedlund, and Tammy Bobrowski, talking about what we are reading this summer, what we want to read. What have you been reading? What is on your list? Text us at 218-326-1234. Here's Raina Del Cid.
Shoving books on the night shift, it takes some time, but I guess I like it. Dewey's decimals keep me company. Out the window, you are dancing with those girls who can't stop laughing. Lip gloss too hot, fake big drama queens. And you were drinking a
Justin Glaw is a writer and independent journalist who started his career in small Midwest newspapers, including the Bemidji Pioneer, and he went on to have his work appear in The Guardian, Rolling Stone, The New York Times, The Daily Beast, and more. If I Am Coming to Your Town, Something Terrible Has Happened is the title of his first book. It is a visceral and raw account of this last decade of police killings, protests, and massacres across the country that Justin reported on, and his addiction to alcohol that mirrored the country's descent into darkness. The book is Justin's attempt at coming to terms with being entrenched in such chaos and finding his way to recovery. I'm Tammy Bobrowski, producer and host of What We're Reading, and joining me is KAXE News Director Chelsea Perkins. We had the opportunity to talk with Justin about his new book.
I was working on the book before I got sober, you know, which has been about 4 years now. Regardless of the whole recovery aspect of it, you know, the reason that I was working on this book even prior to that, because as I was going around the country reporting on these things and writing about them, I just had this sense of like, am I the only one seeing all of this crazy, violent, you know, sort of decline type stuff? And am I the only one that feels like this is all very bad in a way, you know? So it was sort of like almost like a cathartic thing. Like I was writing it to make sense of what I was seeing over all these years in all of these different places, sort of with the thought that, like, surely I can't be the only one who's viewing this through this lens, you know?
I remember you, Justin, as a reporter for the Bemidji Pioneer back in about 2013, particularly for your Homeless in Bemidji series. And you write about your experience there in the book. You were still pretty early in your reporting career. So I'm curious, how did your time in Bemidji inform the rest of your writing and reporting career?
Oh, it was incredibly formative for me. You know, I mean, that was my first opportunity really to do the kind of reporting that I felt like was important and needed to be done. And, you know, so I was really fortunate to be given that runway. And, you know, in the end, things didn't work out, you know, for me at local newspapers. But for that brief period of time in Bemidji, reporting on, you know, the homeless issue and, you know, other issues affecting the Native community, I mean, that was in a lot of ways, like, It was both a very happy time and a very dark time for me personally. And I say I was happy because I felt like there were some, like, systemic important issues that needed to be addressed, you know, because I'm not supposed to do this, right, as a journalist, but I do approach things from, like, an ideological standpoint, really, that, like, I hope things will get better for everyone, you know? And so, you know, it was happy because I was able to, like, do some stories and hopefully bring some important issues to light. But also, you know, it was some dark subject matter. You know, there was, being homeless is not fun. It's not like a happy thing that people end up in that situation for so many different reasons. But, you know, there is a level of sort of darkness about that life. And there was a lot of alcoholism and mental health issues and things like that in the homeless and in the Native communities. And I was in the middle of that for my time in Bemidji. So it was incredibly formative. And really the big takeaway that I have from it, that went on to, like, inform what I've done since then is, like, this stuff still matters. Like, telling important stories about people who are often overlooked still matters. And the reason that I learned that lesson is because of the response of the community in Bemidji, that people paid attention to it. It, you know, they took it seriously. I mean, they even went and started the coalition, and, you know, there's a shelter now. And, like, that is almost unheard of in other parts of society where as journalists, we write about and we report on, like, serious systemic problems all the time, and nothing ever seems to happen. Nobody ever seems to try to alleviate those problems. And Bemidji was the exact opposite of that. They read those stories. They took it seriously. They said, wow, you know, obviously people knew this was happening. It wasn't like, you know, they never knew that and I showed up and miraculously opened their eyes. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not trying to say that, but I was so, like, heartened and impressed with what happened as a result of those stories. And it really, like, you know, people talk about restored your faith in humanity. I mean, it's a great example of that.
Justin, in your book, you talk about earlier in your life, you did work like lawn care and mechanic work and various other types of work before you sort of maybe accidentally kind of ended up in the world of journalism. I'm curious how you think about having that experience, that untraditional experience of entering journalism without having gone through journalism school or any sort of training, how that both helped or hindered your career as you moved forward.
Great question. You know, I mean, first off, I'll say that when I that sort of non-traditional path of like working quote unquote regular jobs that a lot of people work didn't used to be non-traditional. At the paper in my hometown and at the paper in Bemidji and lots of other small and mid-market newspapers, the writers and the reporters and the editors and the photographers and the staff at those places, they all used to come from sort of more, you know, working class backgrounds. So like it didn't used to be non-traditional to do that. I think it's only really been in the past since basically, you know, we as a society really put an emphasis on go to college after high school, you know, like that was really when it started shifting towards like journalism becoming more kind of like a white collar career. But my understanding from being at the paper in Peoria was that like, This thing about, you know, you worked a blue collar job and then somehow stumbled into the newspaper world, like that was fairly common, you know, in the people who were the generation and two generations before me in journalism. You know, look, it hindered my career in that I think that my experience working regular jobs and being just kind of like a regular person, for lack of a better term, that can often be grating to people in journalism, because it is now sort of like a very corporate kind of like button down environment in a lot of ways. And I think that like over the years I've learned that, I mean, look, that's part of the reason why I've been freelance for so long, is like I think I'm just sort of like an outside dog, you know. And I think that a lot of people in journalism, especially when we talk about the marquee publications and the national legacy media publications, those are kind of inside dogs. Like those are well-bred, you know, inside dogs. And I'm just not like that, because that's just not how my personality is. But that's also a result of sort of living in the real world and working the jobs like what you describe. It's helped me in that I think it allows me to have a different outlook on what the country and the world looks like, and that informs what I write and report on, you know. And like I think that is important. I think that there should be more diversity in journalism, whether it's racial or socioeconomic or people who come from different backgrounds and stuff like that. Like I don't think that necessarily having the majority of journalists grow up in like an Ivy League environment and then populate the publications that have the most influence in our society, that's not always a good thing.
You do a lot of reflecting on the incidents that you responded to across the country through the lens of what this means for the country as a whole. And you also then are looking at it through your personal lens. There's a lot of discussion about how maybe you're slowly recognizing the secondary trauma that you're experiencing as a result of covering these incidents. Now that you have been sober for 4 years and are kind of looking back at this time, how much do you think your struggles with that changed how you covered and what you chose to cover even throughout that time?
I definitely think that I tended to gravitate more towards the darker aspect of American life and the more sort of like violent and chaotic events because of my mindset of, you know, I was in active addiction. I was in active alcoholism. And, you know, so like I kind of had like a more depressed, I guess, mindset or something. And so that's like where my focus went. I mean, ironically, like it's not like nowadays I write about, you know, like happy go lucky, you know, feel good stories, you know, like I still focus on this stuff, but I never really did it because I was like, oh, I want to wallow in the darkness. I mean, there was some of that, right? But like I did it because like the dark and the violent and the chaotic stuff that I cover, like I like with the homeless, I'm still doing it from a point of like, hopefulness that by doing this reporting and exposing these wrongs or just, you know, sort of like dark situations, that maybe other people will see it and be like, yeah, I agree. Like, that's not good. You know, like I wish it weren't this way. But the reality is that it is that way. And like the only way to, you know, I make the allegory or, you know, the metaphor or whatever you want to call it in the book, like that the only way to really like solve an issue, whether it's my personal, you know, alcoholism stuff or like a bigger societal thing, is that like you have to recognize the problem to begin with. And if we're all just walking around being like, oh, you know, boy, it's really bad that those 57 people got murdered in Las Vegas by a guy with a, you know, assault rifle. It like, but whatever, like, I got to go to this barbecue this weekend. Like, we're never going to like maybe address the like deeper problems that led to that quickly forgotten and very violent moment in American life.
There are a couple of moments in the book where you do some ethically questionable things as a journalist, and you write about them openly in the book. I'm curious now, with some ability to have some hindsight, you know, how you feel about those moments. One in particular that stuck out to me was in Minneapolis when you were covering the aftermath of George Floyd's killing. There's a liquor store that is being you know, raided by people, and you went in and you took a 6-pack of beer and put it in your backpack. So that stuck out to me as a moment of like, wow, like that's something I would not have done as a journalist. But I'm just curious if your thoughts have changed on any of those moments that you relay in the book.
Well, never say never, because you never know how thirsty you're going to be in a potential situation like that, right? Look, I wouldn't do that now because I wouldn't, you know, I don't drink, right? But, you know, would I grab a bottle of water from a store that is, you know, has been looted and everybody else is taking from it? I don't know, maybe, if I felt like I needed water and I was going to be out on the streets for the next 12 hours or something like that. I mean, that to me is like, I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, the bigger problems with the ethical stuff, I think there is far more problems with ethics in journalism than an instance like that. I think that the problems with ethics in journalism have more to do with like having access to power and sort of like whitewashing things so that you can get those stories out, while sort of doing a disservice to the public by like not really talking about what's really going on, because you need to cultivate those sources and have those relationships so that you can get your big scoops and things like I think that's a bigger problem. But I mean, personally, to your question, I don't look back on it as like, oh God, that was awful, I really shouldn't have done that. I look back on it as like, it was a different time. I made a lot of mistakes, but I'm not going to dwell on it, you know? And like, that's recovery brain talking right there. You know what I mean? It's just not, I never did anything unethical to the point where I look back on it and I'm like, feel really bad about who I am as a human being. I made questionable choices and I made mistakes just like all of us do in any job or in our lives, you know? And I think like that's what is a little bit of what separates me as a reporter from others.
You talk about how perhaps there is something innate within the job of journalism that is addictive in and of itself, that people with addictive personalities may be drawn to this sort of a career. Explain a little bit more about that theme that ran through your book.
For me, it was a specific addiction to, you know, sort of like chaos and adrenaline type stuff, you know? And whether you're doing this, you know, in environments like what I've been in unrest situation and things like that, or you're just the local city council reporter. You know, I don't mean to, I'm not saying just that, whatever. Like you still get that sort of dopamine hit of finding out something and it's important and people need to know about it. And maybe people in power were trying to hide that thing that you found as a reporter. And like, there is adrenaline and, you know, that can be addictive in its own way. Right. Because I don't know how to describe it. Like, I guess you wouldn't, people think of adrenaline as like, I don't know, like skydiving or something like that. Right. But this is sort of like, I guess like a sort of mental, you know, more sort of analytical or intellectual type of adrenaline that we're talking about here as reporters, where we're like, somebody has maybe done an injustice upon people who don't have as much power as they do. And like your job, to oversimplify it, is to go out and like expose that wrongdoing. Like that's pretty adrenaline inducing right there, you know? So I think I'm far from the only person who has that personality type, and that personality type also lends itself to substance use and alcohol use and, you know, all those other things that sort of like feed that need or that desire to like feel good and feel, you know, strong and powerful and all the things that are involved with addiction and stuff. And, you know, I think there's a reason that there's a lot of journalists who are also heavy drinkers, as I used to call myself, you know, and there's a reason that those two things go together, I think.
You mentioned recovery brain, Justin, and and I'm so glad that you're kind of, you know, seeing your way out of the addiction. And your book seems to be saying a couple different things as far as like recovery for yourself, but also I think you're speaking out to the country to recover from a lot of this turmoil and darkness and violence that you have been covering in the past decade. Is that what you were trying to get at with your book?
Yes, absolutely. You know, like I said before, it's like the recognition of a problem is the first step towards like finding a solution to it. And, you know, to Telchi's point about the addictive nature or whatever you want to call it when it comes to journalism, I think that like societally, with social media and smartphones and an insanely fast news cycle and all of the addictive and dopamine inducing you know, things that go along with social media and everybody having a supercomputer in their pocket, you know, like I think that as a society, everyday people have learned about that and are addicted to the chaos and the dopamine that you get from the likes on your Facebook feed or just endless scrolling, right? And I think that like as a result of that, society wide, we have sort of like decided that like, it's weird, right? Like we have more information than we've ever had, but when bad things happen, somehow all of that information like allows us to detach ourselves from it. Like it doesn't seem real, I feel like, you know, like you see videos of mass shooting happening or something, and like you would never have access to that material 20, 30 years ago. And now it's just everywhere, right? So like there's been this sort of like mass desensitization that has occurred that really used to only occur to people like myself or firefighters or law enforcement or like other people who are actually in violent and conflict type situations. And now we just all experience that collectively, but through the phone, right? And so it's like, how do you do that? And then also like maintain your sense of humanity that even though you are desensitized to all of this stuff, there are human beings on the other end of that video that you're watching on your phone who are experiencing horrific situations. You know what I'm saying? And I guess one of the bigger points of the book is like, we sort of have to recognize this is not normal. This is not okay. Something is pretty terribly off, and we have to recognize that to be able to try to find a solution to it.
That makes me think of the fact that, you know, you and I have both been in situations where we're witnessing things firsthand as they unfold. But now you can watch a video online. You don't even know if it's real. The proliferation of artificial intelligence is already having a significant impact on the believability of real video, much less the fact that people are believing fake videos. I mean, can you imagine if AI had been around at the time of Ferguson, for instance? How do you see that making things worse for journalism and perception of reality?
I would say it's not just AI, but it is. There has been this phenomenon in the course of my career where, like, it's AI contributes to the death of objective truth, right? And when I say objective truth, I mean that, like, 9 out of 10 can look at a thing and they can say, like, this is bad, right? That shouldn't have happened, right? And maybe there's one person who's like, ah, no, screw that person. You know, they had it coming or something like that, right? But in the course of my career, not just with AI, but because of the increasing, not just like polarization of our political lives, but the sort of like extremist, ever increasing, like the what we get out of it, you know, whether it's a dopamine hit or adrenaline or whatever, all of that stuff has contributed to the death of objective truth. In that, when something happens now, those 9 out of 10 people will decide whether or not it is good or bad based on their position in the culture war battles that we are waging against each other, right? That, like, I truly believe that if something like the George Floyd video would have come out, say, back when I was working at the paper in Bemidji, 9 out of 10 people would have looked at that and said, this is objectively one of the worst things I have ever seen, and it should not have happened. Okay. By the time 2020 arrives and the George Floyd thing happens, briefly, very briefly, that was the case. Society-wide, we decided, wow, terrible. Put that cop in jail, right? Within 3 months of that, everyone had retreated to their corners of where they are on the culture war spectrum. And then it became, well, he had fentanyl in his system. Well, he was trying to pass a $20 counterfeit bill. Well, did you hear about that time when 3 years ago or whatever he, you know, got arrested for this, or, you know, he had a arrest for like an assault on a pregnant woman or something like that, right? So, like, we have very quickly gone in the course of my career from a place where, like, we could all look at something and come to at least some sort of common ground on whether or not it was good or bad, to where now that incident, whatever it is almost just immediately put ourselves into camps of it, if it is good or bad, based on our place on the right or left culture war spectrum, right? And I think, like, that is the big theme of the changing information ecosystem that you're talking about.
Yeah, January 6th would be another example of that. And
yes,
of course, in Minnesota, we just experienced that fully with Renee Good and Alex Preddy. You have an epilogue in your book that basically ends, you know, shortly before the Operation Metro surge. And this yet is another example of an incident where I could see you out there reporting on it. You know, but what was interesting about Operation Metro surge, I think, that had it stand apart somewhat, is that it did not ever devolve into a riotous situation. It ended up being having a little bit of a different flavor. I'm curious if you have any insight or thoughts on why this felt different than previous.
Great question. I mean, I certainly was anticipating that was going to happen, you know, that things were going to devolve. I think that part of the reason that it didn't is because of the culture of Minnesota, honestly. People in Minnesota, I think on average, and I'm sure there's some academic study that proves this point, but I think that people in Minnesota are more civically engaged than like almost any other state in the country, right? And so there is like a level of involvement there that leads to more sort of measured responses, even to things like the insanity of the Operation Metro Surge, right? Like even something as obviously sort of crazy as that, people were able to respond to it in like a measured sort of like analytical way where they were like, well, if we disagree with this as an individual Minnesotan, here's what we need to do to sort of push back on it. And because of that level of like community organizing stuff and civic engagement type stuff, I think that people in Minnesota were able to not like overreact to it. Whereas in a lot of other places, there's perhaps a little bit less civic engagement and there's more of a sort of reactionary thing that happens, you know, like in Los Angeles, not last summer, I guess, but maybe it was last summer. So like when a similar thing happened there was a lot of, you know, younger people and people who maybe who aren't as engaged who saw the ICE agents on the streets and just got really, really pissed off about it. And so when they went and they interacted with those people, that sort of training, I guess, for lack of a better word, that Minnesotans have about how to push back against things that they dislike in government and society, it wasn't really there, right? So now they're just on the streets and they're interacting with masked ICE agents and, you know, things just get crazy, right? Whereas like in Minnesota, I think people had better training for it. But you bring up a good example, you know, with Alex Preddy and Renee Good, that's almost a picture perfect example of those things happened. And the window of, as a society, we were like, wow, that's terrible. That should not have happened. That window shrunk down to like hours, within hours of those two killings happening. You know, there were millions of Americans who are on the right-hand side of things who were like, well, they shouldn't have done that. And they got what they deserved, you know?
Yeah, as a local journalist, I just have to say too, I didn't get to mention this yet, but your descriptions of the diminishing newsrooms was so on point, and was something that I have personally experienced having moved from the Brainerd Dispatch to this role. That really stuck out to me as like I could really relate to that. I think a lot of times people don't think about, you know, they think about rural places as not having stories to tell, and you did that a little bit in your book. How did that change for you, the perception of a rural place not having stories to tell through the work that you've done in rural places?
I mean, I think they have more stories to tell, right? And I think that the disintegration of local news only increases that news value, you know, that there's fewer people out there reporting on the same amount of news or more news that is happening. But, you know, I also hope, and I this is one thing that I wish I'd done a better job of talking about in the book, is like, I hope that people, when they read what you just described about the diminishing nature of newsrooms and local news, like, I think that a lot of people, regardless of what career they're in, like, we are in a massively changing society here. I mean, people who I grew up with who went to high school and got a job at Caterpillar, and you were going to get 60 a year and you were going to get a 401k, they should be able to recognize those scenes from emptying out newsrooms from their own lives of working in factories that have diminished. You know what I mean? Like, there's, and it's not just like manufacturing jobs either. I think that there's lots of people in lots of different careers and workplaces who will identify with what it looks like to see something that you thought was an institution that was like really never going to go away, disintegrate in front of your eyes and in a relatively quick period of time, you know? So I hope that, you know, it doesn't just apply to other reporters who have, you know, watched it firsthand, but that other people can identify with it too.
So Justin, you really take us on a ride in this book with your reporting, with your life. And so I felt really invested in asking, like, how are you doing now? Are you still reporting? How is recovery going? And just how are things right now for you?
Fine. I mean, you know, I hesitate to say great, but, you know, I mean, like, they're good, you know? And like I said before, it's not like I now don't report on bad stuff. I mean, I was in LA last year for the unrest there. And I joked with like people that I needed to go there to get my annual dose of tear gas, which is like, it's very true. Like I still do when I see unrest situations, that hair on the back of my neck stands up and I'm like, I gotta go, you know, I gotta be there because I want to see it. And I want to be able to like try to understand it, I guess, you know, in that specific situation of why it's happening. And yeah, I mean, so like I'm still reporting on, you know, some pretty serious and troubling things. You know, I just did a big story last month about a rapidly increasing number of deaths of immigrants in ICE detention centers, you know. And so I was right back to where I was 15 years ago or whatever, like calling up medical examiners and getting autopsy reports and going through them. And so like, it never really ends, you know, it's just that now my life is just like a lot more balanced. And whereas I used to just sort of like sit in that stuff and it was like all I did and all I thought about, you know, now I'll work on something like that and I'll do the tasks that I set out for myself for that day or that morning or whatever. And then I'll go play guitar or I'll go work on something on my house or I'll check in with somebody who I haven't talked to in a while. And so like, I've found that that is a really good sort of system for me to continue doing the work that I feel like is important, which often involves talking about and thinking about and reading and researching and reporting on like some pretty bad stuff with, you know, also let me take a step back from that and walk outside and like recognize some of the really good things that there are out there around me, which means in the world.
The time we have been waiting for. Summertime. Some people read different things.
Some
people read more. Some people read less. We called in our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski, and sticking around with us is the avid reader herself, Chelsea Perkins, our news director. Hey, guys. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Hello again.
Okay, so Tammy, is your summer reading different than other times of the year?
It actually isn't. I try to make time for reading all year round, but I can definitely see the interest in particular summer reads. But myself, I'm always reading something, and so it doesn't really change. I was thinking about that earlier, but I bet a lot of other people have some really interesting books that they're trying to read this summer.
Well, and even just reading, my reading patterns change. For me personally, I was just talking to Malachi about this last week. I've been in a bad habit of reading at night where I'm reading 4 pages at a time, maybe, and slogging my way through books because I'm tired and I'm not getting very far. Whereas as now that the summer is here or the warmer weather is here, I'm finding myself grabbing that in the morning and getting through. And so it's like, it's, I don't know, the weather change has shifted the way I'm reading, which is good. I needed it.
Right.
I find myself reading a little less in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Just
because I'm like, if I have free time and it's nice out, I feel like this guilt, Minnesota guilt of like, I must be outside. I must enjoy the moments of beautiful weather that we get. And I know you could certainly grab a book and read outside. Maybe I should do more of that.
Beach reads, right? We're all under our beach umbrellas reading the light fiction taking place in Nantucket.
Yeah. So in preparation of talking about summer reads and beach reads, I went and found, it's probably going to be backwards on my screen, it's a book called Books for Idle Hours. Huh. And it's all about the 19th century publishing and the rise of summer reading. Huh. So I wanted to know like why we are so into summer reading. I haven't gotten through the book yet, but it really gets into the history of like in the late 1800s, the summer travel, leisure became a thing with people. That's when people started traveling for vacation, and publishers kind of wanted to get in on that. So they pulled up their backlists and created and printed books specifically for traveling. So there's a whole industry behind it that kind of works with the whole culture of it. So it's a really interesting look at why we are such fanatics for reading in the summer.
That's so interesting. I didn't even realize that there would be like a, especially dating back that far for right. that historical aspect of it.
Right. Yeah.
It's sort of, you know, this week, Andrew DeZingle yesterday, there's a new bookstore, another new bookstore in Bemidji that is a romance bookstore. And I think a lot of people don't know how popular romances are. And that's kind of what we're talking about when we say beach reads, you know, but it is a huge, huge industry.
It is immensely popular and so many subgenres. And that's why many shops of the romance genre can exist. So, and a lot of the early books were definitely geared towards romance for women. They took place at like resorts and islands, vacation islands, and places that people were likely to visit. So it was all kind of structured around that.
And, you know, this is really exciting because we've all lived through the time of where bookstores went away. And first it was big chain bookstores, and bookstores kind of went away, even the chains. And then now they're slowly coming back. I saw the other day there's a new bookstore in Chisholm, downtown Chisholm, too.
It's so great, isn't it, to just take some time and go to your local bookstore and just walk around and see what they're reading in that area, what mm-hmm. the bookseller has kind of checked out and has kind of researched to see what people in that locale are reading and putting those books forward. So it's so great to visit all these local independent bookstores and see what everyone's reading in those areas.
Do you think with that, tying back a little bit to the romance genre, it almost seems like there's this resurgence at the moment. It's always been very popular. I worked in a used bookstore that, I mean, the romance section was massive. But I also feel like there's this more, it doesn't have to be something that you're ashamed of now. Whereas I feel like before you'd like sort of, you know, like on the sly read, like maybe a book that someone would judge you for. And now it's just like everybody's reading them.
I remember my mom had stacks of Harlequin romances. Yeah. And so that's the series, you know, Harlequin 1, 2, 3, 4. She had stacks of those in her bedroom. And I don't know if there's still like a stigma to reading those in particular, but they've really branched out in LGBTQ romances and dark romances. And there you've got lots of Christian romances. I mean, it's like across the span, across the culture, there's a romance for just about any kind of person, I think. So I think that has really taken off. Who's reading a romance right now out of you guys?
I think I do too. I think it would be called that. But what are you reading?
I don't want to say.
What are you doing here? Tammy, how can we get her to
Stigma.
Say it? Okay.
What are you reading?
She really doesn't want to say
it. No. Oh.
Oh, okay.
It's a little spicy for the air this morning. It's 8:15, guys.
Wow.
This is an 8 p.m. conversation.
I thought she was teasing us.
You're not reading an excerpt, Kari. You're just telling us the title.
There is a subgenre of erotica as well, right? Is that what we're talking
right.
about, Kari?
Yeah.
Okay. No judging. I have picked up an author that I really enjoy that's a lighter fare. This one is a summer one, but in a bit of a romance, but also a mystery. Her name's Mary Kay Andrews, and her books are just delightful. I was telling Kari and Aaron that one of them, she's got a couple, two or three that are about a woman who runs a vintage store. They take place in the South. But the one I'm reading, I realized I had missed one. She's got a new one that's coming out, so I was kind of waiting on that. But I'm reading Summers at the Saint, and it's about a big resort in, like a five-star resort in Georgia, and something that takes place there, and it's a family-owned resort and a lot of mystique and all of that kind of stuff. So it's fun and kind of light, even though there's, you know, a murder involved.
I'm not much of a romance reader, I'll be honest. It's very rare that I mix that in. The closest I've gotten recently was The Wedding People, which I don't know if you would call that a romance, but it has some of the vibes of like that genre a little bit of, you know, being taking place at a hotel. It's set at a wedding and there is romance that happens, but it's not so much the main focus of the book. I don't have anything personal against it. It's just what I just don't gravitate toward that genre.
Remind me, Chelsea, are you fantasy or what is your normal?
No, I'm more just like a literary fiction girly. Okay. That's what I gravitate towards the most. I also like thrillers and mysteries, but kind of a genre spanning. In fact, I did just read the first fantasy book that I've read, like more high fantasy. I've read a lot of like magical realism type books, but I just read the first fantasy because I'm part of an online book club and they chose it. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to push myself. I'm going to listen to something I don't normally. And I actually really liked it. It's called The Children of Gods and Fighting Men by Shauna Lawless. And it's more even just historical fiction with some fantasy elements. If you're into Irish history, there's a lot of like actual real Irish history mixed into it that I had knew nothing about. So I learned a lot in that one too.
Tammy, how about you?
I just read, I'm holding it up because it's the cutest cover ever.
Aww.
It is a illustration of a cute little griffin dog. He looks pretty grumpy and he's wearing a little red handkerchief. Very cute. It's called Social Animals. And I did read it because I have an interview coming up, but it was very enjoyable. So it is like three women kind of meet at a dog park in Maryland, and they all have dogs, and pretty soon you come to realize what each woman is kind of hiding a secret, and they're all kind of connected. So you've got that kind of, it's not really a full out mystery, but you're kind of working out like how all these women are somewhat connected. And they all have dogs, and dogs play a pretty big role in this book, which is really fun. I feel it's important, and it's not a spoiler, but it's important to tell you that no dogs die in this book.
Because appreciate that note.
That is so important to know. I get so angry when I read something or watch a movie and the pet dies in it. I'm like, why does that happen? That doesn't need to happen. So no dogs die.
My kids and I joke all the time about children's movies, and it's like, no, of course a parent dies.
Why?
Like, obviously, yeah. There's going to be something tragic in here.
No dogs die is a very
no
good
dogs die in this
title.
Book. It's really witty and fun and fast paced. So it was really enjoyable, satisfying read. But the dogs have a really fun role in it. So it's fun to read a dog centric kind of book.
Yeah, I think of that. You know, not even so much romance, but I think of that. The way you describe that as a summer read, you know, something mm-hmm. that might be funnier or a little bit lighter. I know last time that we gathered to have our book talk, Chelsea, you were full on into the
Finlay Donovan.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you heard it's a movie coming out.
Yeah. I think it's a series. Tina Fey is going to be doing. And actually, Sarah Bignall texted me over the weekend to say, I'm blowing through Finlay Donovan. So yeah. That is a great example of a summer read, I would say.
Mm-hmm. When you know you have a bunch that you know, if you like it, you can pick up a whole bunch of them.
I've got a couple that my sister just gave me one that she loved by an author that we really have enjoyed before, Sochi Gonzalez. She wrote the book about the artist, Nita DeMont, this book that years ago that was so good. And she just wrote this other book, Last Night in Brooklyn, which my sister highly recommended. So I'm going to be reading that one. And then my mom just blew through Theo of Golden, and like everyone in her sphere is reading this book right now. And I think that's also becoming a movie or a series or something. She loved that one. So
I read that too.
Did you?
And I really liked it. I mean, I will say that I think it's a little cheesy, but like I leaned into the cheese but I have seen it be somewhat polarizing as far as some people like really being coming out and being like, I can't believe people like this. But it was a debut and the author is like in his 70s writing his first novel. And I like that as being part of the story of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I enjoyed it.
We heard from Michael and Karen north of Nashwalk. They said they missed the title and author of the Irish historical fantasy mentioned. Did we talk about it?
Chelsea did.
Okay. What's the name of that again, Chelsea?
Yeah. It's The Children of Gods and Fighting Men. And it's the first in a trilogy. And so I am usually also not a series reader. And so I'm like, hey, I actually might continue and read the rest of this trilogy because it was interesting.
You know, I picked up, speaking of thrift stores, I pick up books sometimes that...
From 25 minutes ago,
speaking of thrift stores. Come on, we're all staring at each other still. But, you know, the whole thing of, like, you pick up different books when you go to the library, then a thrift store, then a bookstore mm-hmm. that past is your friend. So I had picked up a book by, and I recognize the author's name. It was Marissa de los Santos. And I was like, I think I've read something of hers. Turns out I read the second and third book of this series, but had never read the first one. But it was so long ago that I didn't quite remember until I looked it up. But what this one did, it's called Love Walked In. I thought of it because you talking about parents dying, that has happened within this book. And girls taken care of by someone who is not her parent. And so Anne of Green Gables is mentioned a lot and those kind of books. So it caused me to reread Anne of Green Gables because I was reading that, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
We were talking about movies or TV series with the Finlay Donovan book. And I'd love to mention a couple books that are soon to be movies. And I think summer is a really great time to tackle those. And because the movies are either coming out this summer or coming out in the fall. Homer's The Odyssey is a movie that is coming out in July, and it's a star-studded cast. Christopher Nolan is directing it. And if you want to pick up The Odyssey again and refresh yourself on that story, they're using the 2017 book, which is translated by Emily Wilson, and she is the first woman to have published a translation of Homer, which is incredible. In 2017 is when she wrote that. So it's incredible that she's finally the first woman to have translated it. So I think that's pretty significant, and that would be an interesting book to pick up again if you wanted to get back into the Homer's The Odyssey. Narnia, the Magician's Nephew, is going to be coming out. And of course, C.S. Lewis, that's another book, especially with your kids, you can pick up again and revisit that story. Kristen Hannah's The Nightingale. That's her 2015 World War II novel. What's that?
I didn't know they were making that into a movie.
Yeah, I didn't know either. Yeah. So that was an insanely popular book, and that's going to be a movie coming up soon. The Children of Blood and Bone, the YA fantasy by Tomei Adeyemi, is going to be coming out. Of course, Hunger Games has another one coming out too. And Verity, a Colleen Hoover book that was pretty popular too. That's going to have a movie adaptation coming out in October starring Anne Hathaway.
Oh, Hollywood's going to try another Colleen Hoover one?
Yeah.
What was
we'll
the other
see.
One?
Oh, the Blake Lively, that whole thing.
Yeah. Okay. See, I don't think that did too well. Yeah.
I'm not a... Yeah. I think I tried a Colleen Hoover. It was not my...
I haven't read her yet either, but that book I know is everywhere. I've seen that, that book everywhere. Yeah.
And the last one, of course, is Sense and Sensibility. Daisy Edgar Jones is going to be in that. And I love her, so I'm pretty excited. I don't need to reread Sense and Sensibility because I know that story pretty well. But if you have kind of lost track of the story and you think you want to see the movie, it might be a good time this summer to revisit the book.
You guys want to mention any other books or recommendations for folks?
Well, I will just throw out there that I just read If It Bleeds by Stephen King, and I am a big Stephen King fan, and I had been waiting for that one forever on my list. I had it on hold, and there was only a few copies, and it was it's actually a couple of novellas all put together, and I kind of like when Stephen King does that, just these shorter stories within, and I really enjoyed it. It was great.
Well, I got to meet Lori Schall at the Kick It with KXE event, and she recommended, she's our staff photographer, she recommended to me On the Calculation of Volume 1 by Solveig Ball. It's a Danish, it's a translation of a Danish novel where a woman is reliving the same day over and over. I know you're thinking Groundhog Day, but but the movie, but it's a much more contemplative version of that. So I'm just about 50 pages in or so. It's pretty interesting. It's low key. It's not like a lot of action is happening. So it's more about, you know, that process of what you're thinking when every day is the same and what you actually do. So I'm pretty excited to get further into it.
Are you saying Bill Murray wasn't contemplative in Groundhog's Day?
He probably was, but
until
we didn't
the very end. We saw it at the maybe at the very end.
I mean, wouldn't you do some of the stuff he did, I guess?
Probably. Yeah. All right, that's been our book talk, and we'd love to hear what you are reading or summer suggestions that we're going to hopefully wrap this all up. Heidi and I have been writing down all of these suggestions, so if you have some, send them in. Text us, 218-326-1234.
Tammy, what's coming up Monday on what we're reading?
This Monday, we do not have a new one, but I am interviewing lots of people this next week. I'll be interviewing Byron Graves. He is the former Red Lake Nation writer who has a new YA novel out. And then Camille Perry, I'll be interviewing her as well. And Jim Gallagher, I should mention, did an interview for what we're reading. It's cut from the book Where the Green Light Shines, a 50-year odyssey from the boundary waters to the far north. It is a book about Bob O'Hara, who is a famous canoeist in the canoe world. So Jim got to talk to the author, Ryan Rogers, about that, and he produced a piece for what we're reading. So I'm excited for that to air.
Fun. Thanks, Tammy and Chelsea, and we'll catch up with you guys soon.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to KAXE Rewind, special What We're Reading edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Back Porch Harmony with your host Jen Buey and Rainbow Trout. Taking us out of this rewind is Spoon, written in reverse.
I've seen it in your eyes. I've seen you blankly stare. And I wanna show you how I love you, but there's nothing there. Riding
there's only one of us you truly felt.